Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Deval Patrick is here for the monthly Ask the Governor, and we hope you will ask him. We'll cover casinos, DCF, international travel, liquor licenses, racial disparities, and more.
And Alex Beam on the firing of New York Times editor Jill Abramson and the inviting, followed by the disinviting, of college commencement speakers. Then one half of the world-famous Penn and Teller joins us on his star turn in the ART's magical new production of The Tempest, and Innovation Hub's Kara Miller on the crazy of too much choice. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
Joining us in Studio 3, as he does once a month, is the governor of the Commonwealth of Deval Patrick. He will take our questions and yours this hour. You can get to him at 877-301-8970. We are streaming this live at WGBHnews.org. Hello, Governor Patrick.
Hello, Jim, and hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Governor Patrick. Great to see you, as
always. Can you say that on the radio?
I think I can.
See you.
Great to hear you.
Great to be with you.
Great to be with you.
Well, she is seeing you, technically, Governor, so
right.
She can say this.
I just put my glasses
this, yes.
On so I can see right across the table here. So let's start with some of the big news stories of the week. It's been a crazy week for the whole casino situation. Steve Crosby, the chairman, as you know, has recused himself from being involved in picking the Boston Casino, if there indeed there is one in Everett or over by Suffolk Downs. A lot of gubernatorial candidates have said he should recuse himself altogether, step down completely as chairman. You stuck with him. You called it just politics, all this maneuvering on Fox News. I think I saw that there. So what do you think? Are you standing by him for now, or is he going to go eventually? What do you think?
Well, I think the big question before the – I mean, first of all, I don't think that under any of the rules has there been a breach of ethics or a failure of integrity. I think he was right to recuse himself because of concerns about the appearance of integrity around the decision in the eastern part of the state, in the Boston area, as you say. I think there is a big question about what happens at the commission in the event of a tie. They've been doing a lot of their work very, very well, and they have to answer that that question. My understanding is that they're going to take that up maybe as early as today.
You know, one of the issues, though, when you accepted the resignation, at least the second time that Olga Roche at DCF offered it, one of the things that I'm paraphrasing you, Governor, is you said when the public loses confidence, has faith, appearance issues, that sort of thing. Don't the same things apply, whether it's fair or unfair, to Steve Crosby? And I guess a corollary to that, one of my NECN colleagues said, and I think I agree with this, is that having him be head of the commission but not having any involvement in the Eastern Massachusetts casino is like being appointed head of Massport and say, but you can't deal with Logan. That is the – so
that sounds like the kind of comment that would be made by somebody from Eastern Massachusetts.
Well, it might
be. That Boston is the center of our world. As important as it is, the commission has been doing a great job, slower than a lot of us would like, but without a doubt – with great care and thoughtfulness, and I think that's good for us in the long run. I'm not one for sort of ritual resignations. To your original question, I think we haven't come to a point, and we shouldn't jump to a point that when people say off with his head, we should put that head on a stake at the gate. This is a hard job. It's going to be complicated. By the way, we all knew that, right? There's a lot of money involved. There is healthy competition involved, and the interests of communities, you know, as we've experienced it, where people say, "I like the idea of expanded gaming, but not necessarily in my neighborhood," is I think actually kind of predictable too. So the process is gonna play itself out. As I say, I think we should be practical or pragmatic about this, and there is a very pragmatic question right now about what happens in the event of a tie in the East. As I say, the commission has to resolve that question, and soon.
What is a? I'm assuming your response is, well, let's see what the commission says. What possible resolution can there be? 2-2 is 2-2.
No, but there, you know, there. You still got to be able to break a tie, and it's not always by a vote. I mean, there are other ways to do it. Sometimes in real estate transactions, you go to and I think actually this is true at MassDOT. You go to best and last offer, that kind of thing. You know, I've heard people say that in casual conversation, well, in the event of a tie, we start over in the East. There could be a number of – I want to see – and it's up to the commission indeed to come up with their solution. It's got to be simple. It shouldn't be too complicated, and then we'll go from there.
Last thing on casinos from me, at least, Governor. Do you have any buyer's remorse at this stage? My sense from being able to speak to you once a month – is that your enthusiasm for up to three casinos in a slots parlor was far greater at the beginning of the process than it is a couple of years in? Is that a fair
description? No, I don't think that's fair. I mean, my enthusiasm and indeed my involvement had to be higher when we were trying to get a bill. Now we have a law in place, and it turns the responsibility over to a non-political commission, which is, I think, the right way to do it. And so, expressing an opinion, my opinion just doesn't count for very much. I mean, I have views. I have some heartburn about any of these facilities being in cities versus outside the city. You know, put it on an island in the harbor, in the case of Boston. But that point of view doesn't count.
I think that would be fun, actually. Take a little boat out to the casino.
I think it'd be fun, but it's just an opinion. It's not a developer's specific proposal.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to speak directly to Governor Deval Patrick, who will be with us till 1 o'clock.
And just one last question before we get to the calls. The Herald's done a lot of stories in the last week about your foreign travel. Mm-hmm. And I know you defend these as bringing in jobs. But it is a lot of traveling, and we've called it basically junketeering, that you and a bunch of your
you're funny.
Your fellows have gone to like 10 countries in 2.5 years. So what's your rejoinder to this? And
where
are the concrete
results? It's so interesting. We have invited your newspaper and many other media outlets to travel with us in one case. The last time we went to Israel, actually, the first time we went to Israel, in 2011, one newspaper and one TV station came along, and the newspaper reporter, after 2 days, was so wiped out he had to take to his bed and couldn't keep up with us. In the case of Israel alone, there are some 6.2 billion dollars in Massachusetts revenue and 6,700 people who work here in Massachusetts from some 200 Israeli-based companies, and that number has grown to that level on direct account of our having been there and built relationships, and that's one of the reasons why we've gone back. In every place we go, it's very. I mean, ask the business people who come along. We go with a specific emphasis on what our strengths are here in the Commonwealth, around education, around the innovation industries, the life sciences and biotech and clean tech and transportation, for example, and the whole range of digital technologies. And we meet with companies and with sector leaders who are compatible. And that's how doors get open. Now, whether those doors get walked through is up to the private sector. But I can tell you, for example, in the case of the mission to Israel, back to Israel in 2 weeks, a week or so. That is what has provoked your newspaper to comment so much. That when the requests were put out for people to come, I think over 120 people, 120 different companies, large, small, and in between, said they wanted to come, and they've been turning people away.
And they pay their own way, those companies that come.
Of course, yeah.
You know, just one last thing on this whole thing. You just talked about appearances in terms of Steve Crosby and at being the head of the Gaming Commission with these conflicts. There is an appearance, though, that I think concerns a lot of people, that, you know, the Health Connectors in the midst of this massive overhaul mm-hmm. and DCF and so forth. And maybe I'm wrong about this. I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, Governor, that you had criticized Mitt Romney when you were running for governor, because he was traveling all over the place mm-hmm. in the last months of his time as governor of Massachusetts, too. So what's the difference, you know, and address the appearance
issue?
No,
that's fair. That's fair. Look, I think that economic growth is critical to the future. And I don't think you can let your foot up off the gas. I think one difference between the travel I've done and that my predecessor has done is that the travel I do is on behalf of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And it has consistently been, and we have the results to show for it. You know, we have the unemployment rate went down again today to 6%. We are growing as of the end of last year 69% faster than the national growth rate. Last year, 2013, we added more jobs in a single year than in any single year in the 14 previous years, and that was the fourth straight year of strong job gains. We're back in the leadership business. That's the point. And in order to do that, you can't sit at the desk and you know, issue pronouncements and comment on things as a pundit. You got to get out and get engaged, and that means being engaged around the government, engaged around the Commonwealth, and engaged in the case of economics around the world.
Governor, one last economic development thing, since you brought up the term before we do get to the calls at 877-301-8970. You have proposed, or at least spoken about, lifting the cap on liquor licenses. Mm. And my sense, apparently uninformed, is the only people who would ever object to raising, getting rid of the cap would be people who have a liquor license who don't want others to have it. But I've read the heads of a couple of cities, like the guy who runs Lowell, I don't know if it's a mayor or city manager, whatever it is, saying he's worried about more facilities leading to more alcohol-fueled violence downtown. Why hasn't the cap been lifted historically, and is it going to be lifted prospectively?
Jim, I don't know the answer to the question why it hasn't been lifted in the past. And by the way, just to be clear, what we are saying is, you know, you ought not to have to come if you're Lowell or any other city or town to come to the State House and get legislation passed to get one more liquor license for your in order to enable your development or your mom and pop store to get going locally. That decision ought to be made locally. There are so many decisions like that require the blessing of the legislature. And I'm not saying that across the board they should end, but we should limit the kinds of things that come to the State House, to the things that really do have a statewide impact, it seems to me. And this is an easy one.
Are they likely to give up that power, meaning your colleagues?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of interest in it. You know, there are a couple of city council members here, Jim, in Boston, who have been pressing this, partly because the number of liquor licenses that are granted in the South End and the Back Bay compared to new facilities in Roxbury and Dorchester is just way out of proportion.
Yeah, we've talked about that, yeah.
There was a development, I think, in Dedham. I think I'm remembering this right. In Dedham, that was where a big, promising development where the anchor tenant wouldn't make a commitment, was otherwise ready to, but wouldn't make a commitment because they were waiting for a liquor license. And that took months, if not years, to get resolved. And if we're really serious about growing opportunity and accomplishing that by growing the economy, then we just got to make it simpler for people to make their investment decisions and get on with it.
Okay, speaking of getting on with it, we're going to get to the phones, 877-301-8970, Governor Patrick.
Okay, Gail is calling from East Boston. Gail, you there?
Hi, Gail.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from East Boston.
Hi, Gail.
First, I'd like to preface my comment with the fact that I voted no as an East Boston voter on mm-hmm. the Uptown's Casino.
Mm-hmm.
And so my vote was pretty much disrespected by the maneuvers of the Mass Gaming Commission, which decided to negate that vote by changing the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I would really draw your attention to the fact that five would-be governor hopefuls are calling for the resignation of Steve Crosby as mm-hmm. chairman of mm-hmm. the Gaming Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Highlighted by Joan Vanocchi's editorial this morning suggesting he resign.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it really a question of when he will go and not if?
Gail, you there?
Yeah, he's getting pretty intense, so I mean, are we just not prolonging the inevitability of his resignation?
Well, I hope we're not just going to yield to, because sort of a mob mentality. I mean, my executive assistant of now, I want to say 25 years, maybe almost 30 years, is an Eastie resident as well, and she is so hot on this subject.
On which side?
On Gail's side.
Uh-huh.
Feels really, really strongly on this side. She follows all of the hearings, and Gail, she expresses the same concern you do about the. I think what you're referring to is when the vote happened, and then the developer cut a different deal on the. Is it the Revere side?
Right.
Am I right?
Yep. Correct.
Yeah. And I think she feels, and it sounds like you do as well, Gail, that was not kosher. The commission does get to make those decisions. I don't think that the resignation of the chair changes that decision. I think, as I said, the commission, in my view, has done its work. Well, not always making people happy, and I think that or satisfied, and it's going to be that way when decisions get made. But I don't think that I think the remaining outstanding question is in the case of Boston, what happens if there's a tie? And as I said earlier, I think before we got on the call. The commission's going to have to sort that question soon.
Gail, thanks. Did you either directly or indirectly to Steve Crosby or anybody who works with Crosby urge him to recuse himself from
No.
the Eastern Massachusetts?
No.
Okay. Back to the calls, Governor Patrick.
Sure. John is calling from Boston. John, you there?
Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Governor.
Hi, John.
How are you?
Great.
Thanks for calling.
This is John Ribeiro. I'm actually chairing the committee to appeal legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, what we were promised in this state is that we would have done casinos right,
mm-hmm.
that casinos would be an economic panacea, and what we really have on our hands is a real mess. And what this whole process is highlighting is the fact that although many people would be negatively impacted, only a few are permitted to vote on this. And even then, as Gail mentioned, their vote can be dismissed. Now, as I said, we're going to put this question to voters in November.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping, Governor, that you would at least support the right of the people to vote. As you know, the Attorney General has decided that the question is unconstitutional,
mm-hmm.
and that we shouldn't be allowed to vote on it. But I think that on the basics, that everyone in the Commonwealth should have the right to vote on this.
John, we should just say before the governor responds, for those filling in one piece that you didn't, the ultimate decision is not made by Martha Coakley. The SJC, is the Supreme Judicial Court, is now deciding whether or not the question will be before the voters in November. I'm sorry, Governor.
No, that is the answer. I guess I just respond, John, to a couple of the other points you made. Nobody, certainly not me, ever claimed that the expanded gaming was going to be some sort of economic panacea. I also think it hasn't been a mess. It's been slow and unsatisfactory to those communities or those people who wanted it, who didn't get it, and frustrating to those who didn't want it and are getting it or may get it. And I think, in fairness, John, your position and the position of the advocates for repeal was what it was before the issues of the chairman's role. In recusing himself from Boston, so that doesn't sound to me like a real factor either. It's a serious question, and it has been a serious question whether expanding gaming was right for Massachusetts. But we have a democratic process for that, and we had a democratic process for that, and a pretty robust debate about it, as you know.
Do you support, as John just asked, John Ribeiro, thanks, John, for the call. Do you support the right of the voters to be able to cast ballots on this November?
Well, I think I'm a little wary of government by referendum anyway. I think if they are entitled under law to get on the ballot, that's the end of it. If they're not entitled by law to have the question on the ballot, that ought to be the end of it too. But let's not say that there wasn't robust debate over a course of several years. And deep engagement by the elected representatives of the people on the question, and a pretty decisive vote in the end.
You know, Governor, you just mentioned that the employment rate going down and things improving economically in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
part of the whole gaming thing, I always thought, it was the economic disaster we were in back in 2007 and 2008, mm-hmm. that there was almost like a panic sense of, we need this because we need these jobs.
Well, you didn't get that from me.
But I think there was a sense among that people were much more enthusiastic about casinos then because of fear of, you know, an Armageddon, you know, and now things are looking a little bit better.
Well, you know, it's I actually don't. I mean, that certainly wasn't my my approach. I said just a minute ago, I've never seen this as an economic panacea or, frankly, even a centerpiece of our economic growth strategy. Our strategy has been based on investing in education, innovation, and infrastructure, and that's a winning strategy. I guess I would say, though, Marjorie, to take care that because we are doing well, shouldn't mean that we should let our foot up off the gas. That's not a view about whether, you know, there should be or should or should not be a vote on repeal. But one wouldn't say, for example, that we don't want another life sciences company to move into Massachusetts because we got a lot of life sciences companies already.
Let's go back to the calls. He's Governor Deval Patrick. He's with you until 1 o'clock at 877-301-8970, Governor.
Okay. Gretchen is calling from Nahant.
Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
Hi, Governor.
How you doing?
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hey. I'm up in your neighborhood yesterday.
Isn't it pretty?
It's awfully pretty. We cut the ribbon on the new wharf for the ferry service from Lynn.
Very wonderful. I'm dying to take that.
It starts.
I think that's going to be fun.
I think it starts in. Is it early June? It starts on Monday. I'm sorry. It starts on Monday, and it's free for the first week.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's going to be great.
I'm calling to tell you that. Or to ask you a favor,
mm-hmm.
I have lived in Nahant in public housing for 14 wonderful years.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've been blessed and privileged to be able to do that. Within the past 2 years, I have seen the downfall of the Nahant Housing Authority to the point where they really do not know what they're doing. And the woman who is the executive director is in a worse position. She has two other jobs and is juggling this situation that she's in, being our executive director, and just spent over $150,000 of the Commonwealth money on a paving project, which was not ADA, did not satisfy the ADA requirement.
Compliant. Mm-hmm. Curb cuts or something like that?
Disabled public housing, specifically for elderly and disabled. And her attitude is, well, it's what we can do to get a grant, and maybe we can fix it. It's very depressing because it's a beautiful place. The space that it's on is wonderful, but the wasted money is horrendous. We have two units that haven't been rented for over 3 months. We have people who have leases that have not been renewed for 3 years, and they're still paying their old rent amount. It's just a debacle. And I feel like it's so sad because up till now, it was really run well, efficiently. She is just very dismissive of the people in the building and very dismissive of anyone who wants to volunteer to help do anything.
Wow.
So I wonder where I go. I've been in touch with Elizabeth Hayer in the past, but she is gone now, and I really need some help.
Well, stay on, Gretchen. We'll get some contact information for you, and I will do what I can. You know that the housing authorities are independent, and a proposal that's been sitting for some while is to consolidate.
I am so for that proposal.
So that we have fewer of them and more transparency, if you will, around them. It hasn't moved very far in the legislature. But let me find out about your situation, and we'll do what we can.
Gretchen, don't go away. I'm sorry.
Just Gretchen, one more question: Was the paving project that you mentioned, was that around curb cuts and that sort of thing?
It was a complete paving project. We have a very long drive that comes by the building that is beside the building, and it's where our parking is.
Yes.
It's curb cuts. It's handicapped access. It's the whole package.
And are you saying that when you say it's not compliant with the ADA, you mean there are no curb cuts, that kind of thing?
It's not accessible, right? The grade has been the grade is not correct.
I see.
And the doors, we have no accessible doors. Out to the pavement.
Yes.
And that was part of the project.
Yes.
Gretchen,
yes,
do not go away. Stay on hold, and one of our producers will get your number and give it to the governor's office. Governor, just in a minute before you have to take a break, speaking of putting your foot on the gas, as you mentioned a minute ago, I think I get this right. The Highway Trust Fund money, which is very important to states, including ours, my understanding
the
is
federal highway. Federal,
I'm sorry, runs out in the fall, in October
it's
or
crazy.
Something. When you were here last month, I said to you, what regret do you have about something that you know will not be accomplished before you leave office? You didn't want to answer. Then you finally said transportation infrastructure stuff is a lot more to be done. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the potential consequence of this is horrific.
Yeah.
What's the deal?
Well, it's there's some estimates that 50% of the bridge projects that we have on deck would have to slow or stall if the Highway Trust Fund is not replenished at the federal level. We are investing a lot of state money, as I think you know, and we've talked about in the past, in infrastructure rebuild and catching up. But there's so much to do, and it's vital work, and it creates jobs as well, both direct and indirect jobs. There's a project out in Springfield. It's on I-91. It's a viaduct project. It's a I don't know if you know Springfield, but I-91 sort of cuts the downtown off from the Connecticut River, and there's a viaduct which is the main artery into downtown Springfield and connecting Connecticut to Northern Pioneer Valley, and that viaduct project needs to start. It's a few years past due, and it's going to have to be done in a way that we can keep the roadway open, at least in part. But if it doesn't start soon, the roadway is going to have to close, and that is huge in that part of the Commonwealth. And it's a project where I think 50% of it depends on federal reimbursement.
Speaking of transportation, before we go to the break, there's a photograph of you smiling, stylized, I should say, in this month's Boston Magazine, saying that you're riding the blue line at 2:29 a.m., which I find moderately hard to believe.
I'm rarely up at 2:29 a.m.
So that is a stylized, slightly fictionalized
I haven't seen the yes is the answer. I haven't seen the
photograph. I'll show it to you during the break.
You
look good, but it does say 2:29 a.m. at whatever.
Okay, we are with Governor Deval Patrick until the top of the hour, so please call and email 877-301-8970. I'm sorry I haven't gotten to all the emails. There's a lot of them, but I'll do my
best. Can I say that I am now looking at this photograph?
Yeah.
Who rides the subway like this?
Get Boston Magazine. It's quite a photo.
It's a great picture. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We'll be right back with more of Governor Deval Patrick.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
Jim Fitzgerald. Kim Draper.
Deborah Farwell. Susan B. Jones.
Sandra Papson.
Ron and Linda Morse.
Elizabeth Eaton.
Thank you. To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And HBX, the online learning initiative powered by Harvard Business School faculty for college sophomores, juniors, and seniors who want to learn the language of business. Accepting applications for June at hbx.hbs.edu. And from Aesthetic, Reconstructive, and Implant Dentistry, Newton Wellesley, committed to providing a patient-centered, minimally invasive, and scientific approach to dental care and patients' overall health. More at aridnw.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, and he is Deval Patrick. He's the governor of the Commonwealth. Once a month, he comes in here for an hour to take our questions and yours, and this is that hour. Before we get back to the calls, Governor, at 877-301-8970, there was a story that I have a feeling touched a nerve with you in the Globe the other day about a study that had been done about an achievement gap and more in Boston, that two-thirds of the teens, 19 and under, mm-hmm. in Boston are blacks and Latinos, men, I should mm-hmm. say, males. And they go on to quote all these statistics that 49.8% of Latinos, 44 plus point something of blacks are on public assistance by the age of 15. It's the numbers for white teens are fewer, less than half of that. Education, the whole deal. James Jennings did this study out of Tufts, who I'm assuming you know, and he did a study 4 years ago about, I think it was called the State of Black Boston or something like that. There's study after study after study. I know you've talked about it a lot in your 7 years in office. Are we making concrete progress on that front, or is it more talking the talk and not walking the walk?
No, I think we're making progress, but I think it is not fast or dramatic enough. The issues around black and brown men, young men in Boston, are not unlike those in other gateway cities. And they don't lend themselves to just one solution, because poverty isn't like that. It's a combination of education. It's access to it's the creation of jobs, but it's also access to those jobs. And transportation has something to do with that. It's middle skills training, the sort of thing we're trying to do at the RocksMap project we've talked about before, where we have teamed Roxbury Community College up with Madison Park across the street, so that seniors graduating from Madison Park have not just not just the opportunity to take college level courses, but have 1 and in best cases 2 years toward their junior college degree. The pathways initiatives, and there are a number of them, both public and private, that connect up specific individuals to specific jobs within, you know, a short subway ride of the communities we're talking about, are some of the fastest growing entities in the Commonwealth. The opioid and substance abuse issues are affecting those neighborhoods just like they are in the suburbs, and they have been for longer than they were in the suburbs, and they bring some more concentrated attention on that as well. I was at a gathering of black men and boys on Saturday morning, I think it was, called Breakfast for Brothers, and they get together once a month. It's in Mattapan. They get together once a month, and they talk about they talk to these young men and with these young men about becoming men, and they, you know, in a lot of cases, the kids there, and indeed the adults there, grew up without a man in the household, and they talk about that, and they get these young men to express themselves and also understand that the expectations of them are high by the men in the room. And so some of that social engagement, for lack of a better term, that very human engagement, that sort of, you know, the community taking responsibility for its community members, is also, I think, a part of the solution. And bit by bit, it's happening.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor DeVal Patrick, 877-301-8970.
Let's see. Sally is calling from Danvers. Sally, you there?
Hi, Sally.
Hello, everyone.
How are you?
Marjorie.
Hi,
Governor. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
This is not Sally as in former state rep Sally, is it?
It is.
Sally Kearns, who was a state rep a century ago. I hope I didn't out you, Sally, but I recognized your voice.
How did you know? Oh, okay, I was going
to
say.
I recognize your voice. Good to speak to you, Sally. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That gym has been around a long time.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sally.
I've now relegated myself to just doing radio call-in shows.
apparently you and me both, Sally.
I'm sorry, Sally. Go ahead.
That's all right. Well, Governor, you've talked about some of the things that are connected to the issue that I want to raise, mm-hmm. which is children, homeless children living in motel rooms. Mm-hmm. Not only in Danvers, I think there are about 7 communities, Waltham, Brighton, and some other places. Mm-hmm. I know you have a lot on your plate. I know that this is a complicated, thorny problem. DCF, I think, is part of this as well, to the extent that some of these families need to be on someone's radar screen for support and services. Mm-hmm. I want to raise the issue of just the most fundamental matter of safety. Mm-hmm. In Danvers, anyway, they're in motel rooms, 3 people in a motel room, and they have to walk on Route 114 or Route 1 to get to a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, if you could get with Rich Davey and you could get some of your team, I know Aaron is working hard and the nonprofit community, which is tremendous, mm-hmm. you know, and and ready to go to work on it. So I just want to put it on your radar screen, keep it on your radar screen. Do you see a path to ending the policy, and what would it be?
Well, thank you. I'll tell you what I think and what I'm worried about, and then Sally, I'd love to hear what you think some of the solutions might be, because there's by no means consensus. There are a lot of families and a lot more families since the recession who are homeless, and I do want to, you know, it reminds me to go back to a conversation we were having a minute ago, Marjorie, about how well the economy is doing. The recovery has not touched everybody.
Correct.
And we need to be mindful of that. I certainly am. We have, and I have to tell you personally, I hate motels as the solution. But for families, it is frequently a better solution than a shelter. The best solution, obviously, is permanent housing, and the rental voucher program, which is one of the tools, Sally, that we've been using. The legislature in the current budget it looks like they're going to amp that up a little bit. But the availability of that housing, let alone having a voucher for it, is a serious problem. I went out to Chelsea yesterday to the Box District, where in 6 months they put up really beautiful modular housing. So it comes in on a trailer, and they screw it all together, and then they do the finishes, and it's gorgeous. And some of it is.
Danvers is certainly doing. We're you know, exceeding, I think, our requirement. Trying to move quickly. There's a Habitat project going on.
Yep.
Yeah, it can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done.
Yeah. So I think these are some sort of combinations of solutions. You know, Aaron has a view, and by the way, for those who don't know who we're talking about, Aaron Gornstein is the head of the housing division in state government, and is a really terrific and experienced and very thoughtful leader on these issues. And one of the things he's been looking at is more congregate housing. But I will tell you, we're not getting a lot of traction on that in the legislature so far, and I'm worried that simply doing tomorrow what we do today is not going to get us really ahead of the game.
Sally, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for the call. Hope to speak to you again.
Thank you, Sally, for calling in. Let's go back to the calls, please, Governor.
Michael is calling from the car. Michael, you there?
Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi, Marge and Jim and Governor.
Are you using hands-free?
I'm pulled over.
There you go.
Good for you.
There you go.
Wow.
And I think you should rename this segment to "What's Your Gripe?"
What's yours, Michael?
And I have a gripe too. But I would like to take a moment to commend you on your efforts in renewable energy, and in particular solar.
Mm-hmm.
This state, as we all know, or at least we should know, is becoming a national model for solar in this country. And it's because of efforts that you've put in through the Green Communities Act and the Solar Carve-Out Program and the Mass Clean Energy Center.
Mm-hmm.
But my gripe is, now that we have such a successful program, why are they contemplating eliminating the solar rebate?
You mean for homeowners, for example?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I'm an installer of solar. I've been waiting for the time in this country where renewable energy was a viable business.
Right.
And it's been a long wait.
Right.
It's been over 40 years. And it's now finally, and you mentioned job creation in this state.
Yeah.
And it's not a coincidence that in the last 4 years, when job creation has increased, solar jobs have
exploded
dramatically.
Yeah.
Exploding.
Yeah.
So now we have a recipe for success.
Yep.
And the state is thinking about eliminating the rebate program, which, by the way, customers tell me if it weren't for the rebate, they wouldn't install solar on their roofs.
Yeah. So it's a great question, and the question I think that the team is trying to sort out is not whether to eliminate it, but whether to change it. And it has a lot to do with with the fact, as you will know, entry-level costs of solar have fallen dramatically. So the rebate is is attractive. In fact, I used it when we did solar out in the Berkshires 4 or 5 years ago, and we wouldn't have been able to afford it without the rebate, which was brilliant. And the question is, do we sustain it in its present form, or do we do something different to take account of the fact that many types of installations have fallen dramatically in cost?
Michael, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I make one more comment?
Quickly, if you would, sure.
Sure.
Yeah. Prices have come down, but there's still a tremendous sticker shock for the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to look at a $40,000 investment, which is approximately what it costs for an average household, is huge. Now, the money comes from the renewable energy charge on everybody's utility bill. So it's self-funded.
Mm-hmm.
And to make changes to the program, they're not talking about changing it. They're talking about eliminating. I just sent in a comment today, as a matter of fact. The comment period is until next Tuesday. They're contemplating, DOER is contemplating a solar loan program to basically replace it. But that's coming from a different funding source. That's coming from the ACP of the SREC program. So you should have both. If you had a solar loan program and the rebate program, I mean, this and the other thing.
Well, you might be right, Michael. I don't think that it's a sin to consider whether it's time to update the rebate program, and that's what they're doing and what they're supposed to do. And I think there are going to be a lot of comments like yours that were on a roll. So don't touch it. Leave it be, and there are going to be some comments about how to strengthen it going forward. So it's a process, and I welcome your participation in the process.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to What's Your Gripe with Governor Deval Patrick. Governor, speaking of gripes, a lot of people, and you included, are griping about the healthcare website. Most people know it was in terrific shape, and then all of a sudden, the Affordable Care Act connection. Put it into a bit of a tailspin.
Mm.
Reports are we're going to be spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $100+ million to either get a brand new website, or if that doesn't come together by the new sign-up period, open enrollment period in the fall, then we'd allegedly or potentially connect to the feds. Two things. One, what's the likelihood of getting most or all of that $100+ million paid for by the feds?
Mm-hmm.
And two, do you blame yourself for any of the problems we've had with the website in the state?
Well, Jim, on your second question, I'm the governor, so I'm responsible for all of it. You know, it's enormously frustrating. This is especially, this was a privatized project, and the private vendor failed us miserably.
This is CGI we're talking about, is that correct?
It's the same vendor who built the federal website. And a number of other states. And of course, when you turn it over, as we have, although we will ultimately own the intellectual property, the code and stuff like that, they have control of it right now. So even figuring out how much of it we can use on a go-forward basis is a pretty delicate negotiation with them. So we're unwinding. From CGI, the alternatives are not to build a brand new one. It's actually to build off that which we have already bought that we can use, or to use on a temporary basis the federal website. And the problem with the federal website is that although it is functioning well, it doesn't do all the stuff that our own health reform does. Our own health reform provides some affordability subsidies that are not provided at the national level. I don't think anybody wants to walk back from that. So it's incredibly frustrating, and there is risk involved. Although I will say, Sarah Islin and now Maydad Cohen, who are running the project to fix it and make it right, have been doing an incredible job, and they've been really on the consultant who's helping us, and on CGI and the new vendor that we are engaged with, but they've also been quite candid. There's risk involved in getting it right. Now you asked a question about who's going to pay for it. I mean, you know, we're all taxpayers, federal and state, so we are all going to pay for it. So far, the money has come from the federal government. We've told the federal government what the budget maybe, that's an upper limit budget, by the way, maybe to get us a fix, and we're in conversation with them. I don't know how it's all going to short.
Yeah, one quick thing before we go back to the phones. Olga Rochet, of course, is gone as the head of DCF, and a new commissioner is there, Erin Devaney. She was an attorney.
An interim commissioner.
An interim, right. Yeah. Well, and I bring her up because I'm wondering how interim she is. She's not giving any interviews, and there was some sort of, I thought there was some sort of message here that meant she was just there for a short time, and you have a new permanent person in
mind.
But
I'm going to announce today?
Not today, but maybe tomorrow or next week. Are you looking for a new permanent?
No, we are.
You are?
Yeah, yeah.
So there could be a new permanent head before you leave office.
Yes, that's a hope. That's not easy to do, by the way, when you're in the end of your term and you're in a you're talking about an agency that takes this much incoming, you know, deservedly or not. Every day, I will say for folks who have, and there have been a number who express some concern that the person who is the interim commissioner doesn't have a background in child welfare. That in fairness, she was the deputy for operations in this agency,
right?
Before she stepped up, and I really appreciate her stepping up. She knows the agency. We had a commissioner who had 30 years of experience in child welfare. I'm not sure that's where the gap is right now. It's much more about how we implement the reforms that, in terms of additional staffing and technology, that the legislature has so far supported. And there may be more when we finally get the report from the outside expert. So we're looking for someone who has that blend of child welfare sort of substantive depth and also management skill, and I hope we can close on that soon. And the acting commissioner, I hope, will be a candidate.
Okay. Let's go back to the calls, Governor DeVal Patrick.
Let's see. Sean is calling from Groveland. Sean, you there?
Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon, Governor.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
Yesterday, I was part of a group that delivered a petition to your office about the parole of juvenile killers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if you had time to view that petition and what your position may be today.
I haven't seen the petition. I know you were there. I'm sorry that I didn't get to see you. I have heard a lot about that. Were you guys at the hearing yesterday?
We certainly were.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot about the hearing. For the listeners who don't know what we're talking about, and Sean, you please fill in if I don't get it right. There was a hearing yesterday on legislation in the wake of a Supreme Court decision that said that it was that automatic life without parole for juvenile murderers was unconstitutional. And the hearing was about setting what the minimum ought to be before eligibility for parole. Is that fair, Sean?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think the proponent – there are a couple of bills. We filed one, which I think was in the 20 to 25-year range. I think the one that was heard yesterday – maybe they were all heard yesterday, but the one that got the attention was the 35-year minimum, right?
Correct.
Right. And then I think there's this a separate question about what happens with people who are already convicted, who may be eligible for parole as a result of that decision today. Is that I think is what the petition was about.
The petition is certainly about retroactivity, where these cases are long since closed.
Yeah,
and the victims' families here find it particularly unjust to go backwards in an effort to just parole. A few of the offenders that may or may not have been simply accomplices, when those efforts certainly could have been resolved by clemency on your part.
Mm-hmm. Clemency meaning?
Or a pardon. If of the 63 offenders, there are, we'll call it 20, just for number's sake, wouldn't it have been easier to take those types of actions or to find a way to parole just those individuals rather than actual killers? You know what I'm saying?
I think so. But, there aren't any – I haven't gotten any recommendations from the parole board so far. So I think this may be about what we do in the event the cases come forward. And I will look at the petition. I don't think there's any predisposition one way or another on my part or on the part of the parole board. Obviously,
predisposition is what is disturbing victims' families, or it seems that – the ruling came down on Christmas Eve without really having a road to drive on. The parole board doesn't have any parameters to take first-degree murderers' hearings. Yeah. They only have second-degree murderers. And yeah. at this point, there's no separation between first and second degree. They're treated the same. There has to be clear distinction between those two.
Well, that's a fair point, but don't fuss at me about what the judiciary does. They're separate. The question now is, what is the parole board supposed to do within the parameters the judiciary has set up? And I appreciate the point of view expressed in the petition, and I will look at it, and I will see that they look at it too.
Sean, thanks for the call. Governor, you're speaking of parole and the judicial system, which made me think, which I hadn't before, about the Governor's Council, which ultimately decides whether or not there will be judges who you nominate or not. And you recently had a nominee who was rejected by the Governor's Council, mm-hmm. Who, with a controversy I don't think we really need to get into.
You're talking about the Superior Court nominee?
The guy who had been connected to the ADL, though he had protested within the ADL their position about the Armenian genocide, et cetera.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think that's important to get into for the moment. My question is this. In the past, there have been constitutional amendments proposed, including actually by your state senator, I don't know if he supports it anymore, Brian Joyce, to eliminate the Governor's Council and have judges picked and confirmed, like they are, for example, in the United States Senate, mm-hmm. Supreme Court justices. If you were asked to testify at that, how would you testify? Get rid of the Governor's Council or no?
I think we need a Governor's Council. I think we certainly need some check on any governor's power to appoint to the bench. I don't like the systems of elected judges. I've practiced in those. In those jurisdictions, and I think they are fraught for a whole other series of reasons. And for all of the reporting and the occasional frustration, like with the candidate you mentioned, the Governor's Council has confirmed. I think I've appointed 150 or 60 judges, and all but two, I think I'm right about this, they've said yes. So it's not like the record has been bad. Some of the outcomes are not great. Some of the hearings are not pleasant, to say the least. To be sure, and I think the Governor's Council is aware of that. Is self-conscious about that and the criticism they are getting. But far be it for me to complain about the sort of the record of outcomes overall.
My problem with it very quickly, and the reason I broach it, and I broach it not very articulately, was the vast majority of people in the Commonwealth have no idea who their governor's counselor is, as opposed to a state senator who arguably you know, and wouldn't you be good if you knew who it was who was deciding whether a man or woman should be a judge in the Commonwealth?
It's fair that that's a fair point. I don't know that you can blame the governor's council for the fact that the people who vote for them don't know who they are. It's up to us to get informed, be informed about who our counselors are and what their record of decision and behavior has been, and to choose accordingly.
Do you have any idea who your governor's counselor is, Mr. Browdy, over
I
there?
I told you. It is the father of a nice young woman who stopped me as I went into the polling booth in Central Square and said, please vote for my father.
I have covered the hearings. I have no idea who my governor's counselor is.
Do you know who yours is?
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay, fine. Oh,
he's trying to catch you on that one, Governor. you're giving a commencement address this weekend, I believe, at Boston University.
I am.
So have you got it all worked up?
No,
you know
I don't.
Really? Under a lot of pressure?
I am.
You had a great commencement speaker our producer, Chelsea Murris, found today when you graduated from Harvard. Do you remember?
Oh, this is good.
Was it Solzhenitsyn?
Yes.
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Good research.
You are both of the gotcha journalism school.
Yes, we are.
And I beat it back
you
both
did.
Times.
Yes, you did.
We're talking about this in a few minutes with Alex Beam, who's coming in a few minutes after you leave. But I guess everybody's expecting he was going to give this big speech because, of course, he was in exile in Russia.
Right.
The Soviet Union was still there. He's going to come in and praise the United States and stuff. And he did just the opposite, chastising the arrogance and smugness of Western materialist culture. And you've forgotten all about it.
So this is the other thing that one must remember if you are giving a commencement address, which is though you should prepare and be serious and thoughtful and appropriate to the occasion, most of the people there won't remember a single thing you said.
It's awful, isn't
it? If not, indeed, who spoke at their graduation.
Are you troubled by the fact that there's been this, I don't know we're going to get into this, but just for a second, by the fact that the Condi Rices of the world step back from Rutgers when there was a protest as a commencement speaker. The head of the IMF, what was her name, Lagarde, I think,
just
stepped out of the commencement address at one of your daughters and one of my daughters' school, Smith.
Mm.
That happened to a woman at Brandeis who's been very critical of Islam.
She was an honorary degree, though. She wasn't a...
Oh, she wasn't a commencement? No. My apologies. Does that trouble you that there's this...
Well, all the situations are different, Jim. I'm not following the news on all of those, so I don't want to comment, but you know, the one thing people I'm in a time in my life and career where people are asking me constantly, "What are you going to do next?
What are you going to do next?"
And there it is, there it is, and the one thing I am certain I don't want to do, but that has been suggested to me from time to time, is to be a university president, because I say to people, "Look, I'm getting out of politics."
It is the dental floss speech. I thought was a very good one that the woman gave. The reporter talked about things you should do in your life.
Oh, it's one of the most famous Chicago Tribune columnists.
Make sure you dental floss, wear sunscreen. She was great.
I thought, use
why
that on
didn't
Sunday,
I? It was absolutely brilliant. And the guy, the guy George Sanders, that gave the great address about people, kindness, the need for kindness in the world, which he has turned into a best-selling book. So, Governor, this could be a big opportunity.
Well, no, isn't that interesting? I'm so glad you told me that. It must have been fated, because I was going in that direction for Sunday, but I. Evidently, I have to think of a new direction. Now.
No,
thank
why
you
not?
Much.
You could just quote him, or the guy at Wellesley High School that got up and told all the graduates,
McCulloch's kid,
that they weren't special. Deal with
it. You really follow
She's
this,
ready.
Don't you?
Well, I'm waiting for someone to ask me.
Have you written a speech that perhaps I could use?
I've got my speech already, Governor, but no one has asked me to deliver it. So
it's
maybe
coming,
one
Marjorie,
of these days.
Trust me.
Maybe my middle school, my junior high school in Fall River. I don't know.
I tried getting to invite you. It didn't work out. By the way, what we say at the end of every hour where the governor is kind enough to join us and you is that everybody who is on hold, stay there. We'll get your phone number. Everybody who is emailed,
yes,
we will forward the emails.
I apologize because there have been so many emails. We were deluged with emails, and I've only gotten to read half of them. So I apologize to the people that emailed. But we'll hold on to
them. It's because you kept talking about commencement.
It's
spoke
true.
Too much.
We'll
forward them all to the
Usually
governor's
it's Jim
office.
Who does all the
I know. Well, certain
voiceover.
Topics really get me going. You know?
He knows the lingo. Governor, it's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
And we will see you in June.
Thank you. Be well.
Governor Deval Patrick.
Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor. And thanks again for being with us, Governor Patrick. When we come back, it is time for Open Mic with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. We're going to talk to him about Alexander Solzhenitsyn and bounce commencement speakers, and also get his take on the ouster of the New York Times editor Jill Abramson. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, a recent poll says Rhode Islanders suffer from low self-esteem. I'll put the question of why to former Mayor Buddy Cianci. Tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
And so it came to pass. Satan came to Harvard Yard only to be expelled to the Hong Kong. If you missed this story on the radio, you definitely want to catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Boston Ballet. You can enjoy an evening with Boston Ballet as they present George Balanchine's renowned tour de force, Jewels, making its Boston Opera House debut May 22nd to June 1st. Tickets at bostonballet.org. And Call the Midwife, followed by Mr. Selfridge from WGBH's Masterpiece. Tune in for drama from bygone eras. Watch Call the Midwife at 8 and then Mr. Selfridge at 9, Sunday night on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as he does every Thursday, in plaid, I should say, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as Marjorie and I do every Thursday morning, we do every Thursday, we marvel at how fitting it is that his name is Alex Beam, because like Jim Beam, Marjorie said this morning, he is that straight out of the barrel way about him. Alex also has a new book. It's called American Crucifixion. Excuse me. Let me finish, Alex, please. The murder.
That's
of Joseph,
not me giggling.
The murder of Joseph Smith and the fate of the Mormon Church. And by the way, he's doing a reading in Harvard Square on Tuesday night. Marjorie, at the end of this discussion, will tell you where and when it is. Hello, Alex.
Oh, Alex.
You guys are great.
I'm
Why
so
am I
glad.
Always complaining?
complaining.
I'm so glad that you're here today because I can't wait to talk to you about the ouster of Jill Abramson from the world's greatest newspaper,
I am going to be
the New York
a
Times.
Catastrophic disappointment to you personally and to your gender. I don't know because I just... I feel like everything I think about this is wrong, although partly what I quote-unquote think/know about it is probably correct, but nonetheless.
We should explain.
Story,
why don't you explain a little
story,
bit?
The reason I'm so interested in talking about this, she's only been there for 2 years. There was a story in Forbes magazine.
3 years.
Three years. That she had, and Keller was there for 8 years, which is a long time. And anyway, that Jill Abramson was quote-unquote too bossy to run the New York Times, which was kind of an interesting accusation against a woman. And then also she had the temerity to contact an attorney to discuss the pay differential, which apparently was quite significant between her and her predecessor, Bill Keller, and also between a previous managing editor at the New York Times, where she held the job with her. And you did notice that when they announced a new editor, it was not as if the praise was effusive for the departing Ms. Abramson. So she was like axed.
Yeah, I think what you got to do is you got to get alternative programming for the next 50. Because that dog is not going to hunt. That was like last night's dog.
Which dog?
Well, she's targeted because she's a woman. Oh. It's all about unequal pay. That thing won't last another 18 hours. I mean, although I think a much more interesting sort of concatenation of circumstances is looming into view. And I apologize to every woman I've ever known. Obviously, when a woman, I mean, really.
They're all listening.
It's a long, a long list.
Do we have the sound of her voice?
We do. Let him finish the thought and then we'll play it.
Well, anyway, I mean, well, now that you've interrupted me, I really have no
I'm
idea.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I have no idea what I'm going to say. No, but let me just finish. I mean,
go ahead.
It's bad to, you know, when a woman, quote unquote, you know, every word out of my mouth is the wrong word. But I mean, when a woman is managing assertively the way one should do, whether one is a man or a woman, mm-hmm. in you know these adjectives, it's like if Alan Dershowitz were here, you know, he'd say every Jew who's called bossy is a victim of anti-Semitism. I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, he always says
I'd
that.
I'd say you're going to be a defendant in a lawsuit tomorrow.
Yeah, I tell you, I shouldn't
keep
have even shown
yourself.
Up.
Go ahead.
I mean, I'm sorry that she was called bossy or pushy or this. I mean, because obviously she has a very strong personality and is a hands-on, serious news editor. And yes, let's go to the clip of her voice, but I actually have a kind of more – I have a theory about what really is sort of happening here.
Well, was her stewardship,
that will eventually be proven correct.
Okay, was the stewardship was her stewardship of the New York Times good or not?
It was okay. I mean, in no way did she fail.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's hear.
Well, Alex, but I mean, if you read his Twitter account, Alex has been saying for months, this is a pushy woman. Let's face it. So,
he called her.
Here is a little sound, just to get you in the spirit of the moment, from the now former executive editor of the New York Times, Jill Abramson.
The Obama years are benchmark for a new level of secrecy and control. They have really, I think, put a chill on reporting about national security issues in Washington. My colleagues who are still there tell me that the atmosphere has never
obviously
been.
Okay. Pushy and bossy.
Okay.
You can tell right
God
there.
Almighty, okay. I can't take any more of that.
Okay, we have a theory.
What's that?
You want to hear my theory?
I think the theory had to do with her voice.
They didn't want to listen to her anymore? Is that what you're about to say?
I'm telling you, I think it was part of it.
Boy, we were having a decent show until you played that audio clip.
Yeah, it really does.
That was insane. That was like reading T.S. Eliot at 17 revolutions per minute or something.
Have you ever heard her before? That's how she talks.
Is that right?
Yes.
But wait, Alex, I want to get back to your original totally inappropriate comment. This in a New Yorker piece by Ken Auletta, who's not the chopped liver. Can we
agree? He's always wrong, by the way. Well, he was wrong last night, too. But you go right ahead.
Okay. He goes on to say that her firing, several weeks before her firing, as Marjorie said, she discovered that her pay and her pension benefits as both executive editor and before that as managing editor were considerably below, as Marjorie said, Bill Keller. And because she essentially said, this has got to be fixed, it fed into the management narrative that she was pushy, which was the problem with her to that point. Why don't you accept that?
You know, he's just Ken Auletta. He's blogging last night. It's not a fact check, New York.
What did he say last night that was wrong?
That all went off. Well, because this whole that whole pay and pension thing, that's the dog that's not going to hunt. Next week, you'll be apologizing to me, okay? So just get
why
ready.
What do you know that causes you to say it's
I don't
not
know.
Hunt?
Well, actually, I know that, like, for instance, her pension was frozen in 2009. So was mine. I was shocked to learn that this was every employee.
New York Times owned the Boston Globe.
New York Times owned the Boston Globe. So there's, you know, Bill Keller had many more years in on his pension. That's already come out. So there's a definitely disparity in pensions that kind of looks very shocking when Ken Auletta announces it at like 10:30 p.m. at night. But it's real. Well, the probable fact in there, the probable fact in there is that when she was a managing editor or a deputy managing editor, it's highly probable that a man was paid more than she. That fact rings true.
The other stuff is
just BS. There's been tremendous. At the New York Times, now I was slightly different. We were required to take like a 25% pay cut. They've also been pushing down management salaries as well. It may be a quote unquote fact that she earned less than Bill Keller, but that's going to be for exterior reasons. I think this is all about something radically different anyway.
What?
Ha! I'm glad you asked.
What?
Well, just before I walked in here, like about an hour and a half ago, BuzzFeed published the Arthur Sulzberger III report. And
on her?
No.
His statement?
It's this thing that's in the background. It came out like six months ago.
Oh, okay.
Sulzberger's kid, it didn't come out 6 months ago, but it took them, Sulzberger's kid was deputized to produce this thing, this big report about, is the Times doing well digitally? And the report is incredible. It's like hair on fire. The Times is not doing well digitally. We're getting killed across the board. This is a report written by the next publisher of the New York Times. The other guy is like my age. He's played out. He's
Which other guy?
Arthur Sulzberger Jr.
All right. Okay.
It's his son. I mean, this is everything at the Times is in the context of family ownership and needing to make money to pay off the family.
So the rub on her was that she was doing horribly in the digital transition, and therefore she had to go.
I think it's much more complicated than that. Even I mean, okay. I think this place is. It's like Mount Etna. It's a little. I think there's three really interesting places in journalism. There's Bezos and Barron at the Washington Post. There's this lava flow that's just exposed as of last night at the New York Times. Utterly fascinating. And then to a lesser extent, you've got to ask, you know, where's John Henry in the Boston Globe and all this?
Yeah.
But here's the next publisher of the New York Times quoting, by the way, this woman from the Guardian. They clearly wanted to hire her, and so. They're talking about there's been something native advertising this, but it's much bigger than that.
Okay.
There's clearly some kind of digital versus print war, and I think when it all shakes down, you know, Abramson will be regarded as somebody who was intelligent, possibly overcautious, and this thing is really going to explode with this guy Mark Thompson, with the future publisher mm-hmm. Arthur Sulzberger. Maybe they will hire this woman from the Guardian. I don't know. I mean, it's stuff that we can't see. I think it's a very high-quality newspaper.
Well, let me just say one thing
okay,
here
yeah,
that
yeah,
I need
yeah.
to say, because I think it's really true. I don't know this Jill Abramson or not. I don't know how well she did at the Times, but I do know that it is much more difficult to run a major organization like that as a woman than it is as a man. It just is.
Well,
why don't we
also say the thing that all three of us know to be true, and for some reason Alex is not saying.
What's
she
that?
Apparently told the young Sulzberger that under no circumstance could he ever bring Magic Johnson into the newsroom. Now, I think
okay.
it is totally...
I can't believe you're dragging down.
He could do anything else he wanted with Magic Johnson, but not bring him into the newsroom. Let's segue into something that Marjorie broached with the governor. So why don't you take this, Marjorie?
Well, you talked about, you're interested in this whole commencement roulette,
yes.
as we put it here at Boston Public Radio, where these commencement speakers get invited and they get disinvited. Condoleezza Rice invited and disinvited to Rutgers University. The woman at Brandeis, that was not a commencement speaker. She was going to get an honorary degree.
I'm not sure it's how you pronounce it.
The woman that...
Abramson's getting a degree next week, right?
Is that really
on
true?
On Monday.
I don't know.
Where?
Somewhere in New England. I'm embarrassed.
I don't know that. Okay.
Possibly somewhere in Rhode Island.
And Christine Lagarde, who was disinvited from Smith College. She's head of the... What's the name of the World
International Monetary Fund?
She's also the best-dressed woman in the world.
Yeah, she is wonderfully dressed.
She's unbelievable. If Jill Abramson dressed like that, she'd still have a job. Okay, believe me.
Yeah.
So what's your thesis on this? This is just a left-wing cabal kind of thing? Is that where it is?
What are we talking about?
But
the disinvited commencement speakers. I mean, not all of them, but most of them do have that in common.
Condoleezza Rice, by the way, was disinvited practically to Boston College a few years ago, but Boston College hung tough or hang tough.
Hanged tough,
thank
I guess.
You very
hung
much.
Tough.
No, hung in that case.
She
that's
hung,
right.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Hanged.
But in any
if
case,
right.
they, she came and she gave a speech. It was a pretty good speech, actually.
Yeah,
there.
No, I don't have a thesis. Okay. I mean, I don't have an easy. I mean, I just thought it's interesting to discuss because it's not, as you point out, it's not just the left, it's the right. But it really plays into this thing about there's this kind of sort of almost juvenile. It just seems juvenile to sort of hate everybody because they're part of the bourgeoisie. I mean, that means the three of us will never be commencement speakers, apparently.
No, I know. I've
We're
never been
part
invited.
Of the bourgeoisie.
I was a commencement
the hated
speaker.
Bourgeoisie.
But that's
have
okay,
you been invited
thanks.
To be commencement speaker, Alex?
Does high school count?
Yes, really? Absolutely. Which high school?
Roxbury Latin. I was a commencement
speaker. How great was that?
Roxbury Latin is
that's
one of the great schools in America
I'm
for
so
people
proud
that
of
don't
that.
Know.
It's my proudest
that
moment.
That is great.
It's
how
my,
was it?
It's my proudest moment. I think I wanted to deliver a speech that couldn't be reproduced in the school newsletter afterwards, and I pretty much succeeded. Huge portions of it.
Did you swear?
No. But it was a really great honor, and it wasn't terribly uplifting, and I don't think I'll be invited back.
But wait, give us the thrust of one or two things that were not printable, for lack of a better expression. What'd you say?
I made fun of their great. Oh God, I'm going to hell now.
They love this.
I made
I'm
fun
sure.
of their greatest graduate ever, not Christopher Lydon, unbelievably. But Jared Diamond, you know, Jared Diamond got the Pulitzer Prize for Guns, Germs, and Steel. And I reminded the audience, which they had apparently forgotten, that there was once an item. Apparently, when Jared Diamond came to speak, all he talked about was himself and how he knew 55 different languages. So I said, I hope I don't get made fun of the way Jared Diamond got made fun of by the school newspaper.
They like that?
Because their headline was, Mr. Diamond, we are not worthy.
Wow, I'm
that's
impressed.
That's pretty good, actually.
That is, as I
oh,
said,
you're
one
sweet,
of
you're
gems.
Sweet to
no,
be nice about it.
I love Roxbury Latin. It's
I loved
great
it.
School.
I'll give you, I'm so naked. I'll tell you what, when I went to get a fantastic job like 30 years ago, my mom let me out of the car. I was about to go overseas to get a job to meet my wife. Big moment in my life. She let me out of the car, and I was like 30 years old, really intense. And the last thing she said to me was, don't forget to have fun. And I'm just so grateful to her for saying that. So that was my message. But it's not very uplifting. It's not as good as George Saunders'
George
message.
George Saunders was great.
That's who Marjorie mentioned
George Saunders
to
was great. And
Neville
now he's
Patrick.
Got a book in the bestseller list all about it.
I know.
And if people haven't
that
read this
great,
wonderful book of
way.
Short stories, December, they are quite impressive.
No, he's amazing. And
he's
and DFW was amazing. I mean,
who's
I
DFW?
Feel like David Foster Wallace.
Oh, where I mean, does he speak?
Kenyon, hello.
Oh, okay.
Kenyon kind of trumps Roxbury Latin for greatest college in the world.
Are you a big fan of David Foster Wallace?
Oh, that's a trick question. We need 88 more hours.
Okay.
He's a great nonfiction writer. I just started his first collection of stories, which I'm reading for reasons I can't even tell you. They're kind of brilliant, but a little wild. I think Saunders is probably the better writer.
You do? Okay.
You know, Alex, one of the things we do to help promote your career, such as it is...
oh,
is
it really in the toilet now?
Every week that you do have a new terrific book, but putting that aside for the moment, is we discuss your column of the day, which coincidentally is always happening on the day you're here. And yet again, you have talked about somebody no one has ever heard of this morning.
Yes, no, we have.
No,
we've heard of
very
him.
Few have heard. Now, who is John Mack is back, as you say. Who is Dr. Mack?
Or
and
was.
Why should we care about Dr. And by the way, you've got to include how he died because
terrible.
It reminds me of
terrible.
Another great death.
I was like excoriated in the Globe for likening his death to that of Thomas Merton. Can you take the amazing? can you take the amazing?
Yes, I can. An electric fan went into the bathtub and killed him. And how old was Merton?
And he
like
was
50
in,
or 51?
He was in Bangkok at a
That's
Buddhism
right.
conference.
He died.
Oh, wait a second. Before
no,
you go
I
ahead.
Once, I
he
once
was
did,
electrocuted.
I said this in print. I said two geniuses suffered the stupidest deaths in the world. And some
totally
woman,
stupid.
Yeah. I mean,
who
the beautiful writer,
fan?
The beautiful like sort of neo-Catholic thinker, Thomas Merton, dies when a fan comes into his bathtub. And Dr. John Mack, Harvard professor of psychiatry, Pulitzer Prize winner for a semi-question biography of T. E. Lawrence, champion of UFO abductees all over North America, unbelievably is in London in the prime of life, puts one foot over the curb, bang, he's a dead man because he looked left And in London, the traffic comes from the right.
Now, so you, by the way, you would pick Thomas Merton because you two are in a different world than I am. I would pick the finest death
of interesting thinkers.
The finest death of that sort, and I may get his position wrong, is one of the major investors and leaders of the Segway. Do you remember how he died as a state, I believe, in Great Britain? I'm not sure where it was. Do you remember what happened to him?
No, I'd love to hear
the
it.
The Segway is this thing invented by New Hampshire's own Dean Kamen. You remember? It's this thing where you look a little nerdy and you ride around.
Jim had one.
And well, I didn't have one. I've ridden on one. And I actually was in the movie, America 10 Miles an Hour,
and you know
which was about.
They photographed Jim from the floor up.
From behind.
From behind. So
that's
you had
totally
a picture
true.
Of Jim's.
But
do you know
you don't want to be photographed from behind?
No, I don't know this guy's name. Do you know how he died?
No.
He was on a Segway riding around just recreationally on his estate, and he Segwayed off a cliff. And that was the end of this particular. Yes, he did.
That's amazing. That's three fantastic deaths.
No, so why are you writing? Making jokes at your funeral. It's just terrible.
In any case, with the reason you wrote about Dr. Mack.
I hope they make jokes at my funeral.
The reason you wrote about Dr. Mack was not because of well, not only because of how he died, but because of what he believed in, which was what? And quite controversial, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in Mack. I have a number of super dubious scoops to
my
credit.
His name was Jimmy Heselden. He drove his Segway off a cliff.
Thank you.
I just wanted
to bring
it up to speed. Thank you, colleagues. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was bragging about my really questionable scoops. I mean, I had the but Mack was this mesmerizingly brilliant and fascinating professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School who started taking these crazy stories about, you know, people came to me while I was asleep. They put a probe in my rear end, and then they took me into the spaceship. He took all that stuff seriously. He went on Oprah. He had a best-selling book. I quote-unquote broke the story about this secret Harvard investigation into his activities, which was pretty interesting, although I must say I'm sort of two minds about it. But anyway, the Harvard Medical School convened a secret committee. They had hoped it was going to remain secret. However, Mack's lawyer was Eric McLeish, the sort of
I interviewed him last week.
Yeah,
actually,
the great
about
litigator.
Bridgewater State Hospital. Eric McLeish, for those who don't recall, was the lawyer who helped break the story about abuse in the Catholic Church. Sexual
right,
abuse,
and I mean, you know, he's an assertive guy, and so I mean that inquiry should never have been secret. It didn't remain secret. In any case, I always found Mack personally, I had never really met psychiatrists before. Now I know there's a lot of psychiatrists like him who are kind of truly spellbinding. But in any case, I just found his whole story kind of compelling. And the reason I did the column is that, you know, this lady, she's been on my screen for a while. She thinks she's going to do a big feature film about John Mack. She supposedly was talking to Robert Redford for 14 months.
Wow.
And he passed. I mean, they broke up, basically. It's clear the reason they broke up was that Redford's production house wasn't going to treat Mack with kid gloves. And
they're now talking to E.T. instead, but go ahead. Sorry.
No, I have one question about Mack before we go. Jim and I have debated this many times, and maybe you have some new insights into the question. Why is it when the spaceships come and get people... They are always beamed up and probed.
Yeah, what is that about?
Have you thought about that?
That is all. Those are the two things that happen.
They're always
to you.
Beamed up.
Well, you're generally
and then they're
probed. Or you're probed first, generally, and then you're beamed up.
Usually, you're probed in the spaceship. He had it differently. Mack did. He had them probed first and then beamed up. But usually, they're beamed up.
This
and
can
then
be your
probed.
45-second explainer because we forgot to come
yes,
up with
I know,
one
there's
today.
Nothing to explain.
So, how about that?
No. Well.
Thank you.
You know what I love? I love people who go on the radio. That's a good question, Marjorie. Yeah.
I just maybe thought you had dwelled on that issue as we have dwelled on it for many years, and we're suspicious.
Well, you would need a Harvard Medical School professor of psychiatry, I think, to give you the straight answer on that.
Have you ever done that column purely? Oh, it sounds like you did in the Thomas. We got to go, but on the Thomas Merton and the Dr. Mack thing, it did like Jimmy Heselden in this whole series of.
Well, you know, those are called the Darwin Awards. Every year,
we've had those people on. Yeah.
They list like 12 ridiculous ways to die. No, yeah. I've never done a column about that. And I got really negative feedback for making fun of Merton.
Yeah.
But it's terrible. When
it is terrible.
Well,
let's hope we don't have one of those kind of deaths.
When we go to London, let's be very careful.
Okay.
Alex, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
Where is he appearing, Marjorie?
Alex Beam is appearing at the Harvard Bookstore in Harvard Square on May 28th at 7 p.m.
May 20th,
excuse me, when he's going to do a reading from his fantastic new book American Crucifixion. At last, we can name one of the many books that Alex has written. The rest remains secret. Alas, Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. And by the way, American Crucifixion is a great book about the murder of Joseph Smith and the Mormon Church. Up next, we talk to Teller of the Penn and Teller duo. He's in town for his adaptation. He's performing in this or directing in this and arranged it and all that on stage at the Art ART. That conversation next on WGBH.
Every year, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to land some hot deals, and every winning bid supports the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
And so it came to pass. Satan came to Harvard Yard, only to be expelled to the Hong Kong. If you missed this story on the radio, you definitely want to catch it online at wgbhnews.org right now.
Support for WGBH comes from you and National Nurses United, a voice of America's registered nurses, advancing the interests of nurses and patients for better patient care and patient safety. It's registered nurses who put the care in healthcare. NationalNursesUnited.org. And the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at Lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is the man who makes up 50% of the famed illusionist duo Penn and Teller. Teller has brought his magic to Cambridge by way of a new production of The Tempest at the ART. Teller, along with Aaron Posner, has adapted Shakespeare's play, which Teller describes as a shipwrecked magic show performed on a set that looks like the end of a Coney Island pier at night. And who better to do that? You're listening to him now. Who better to do the music for this than Tom Waits and Kathleen Brennan? Teller, welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted.
Oh, we are so thrilled to have you here and so thrilled to talk about this fantastic play at the ART. So you told one of the reviewers that the whole production of The Tempest, and that's the production, began in a dream. What was that? What was that about, please?
Well, my obsession with the strange way that Prospero fights his battles in this play began with a dream. In the 1970s, I bought one of those books about how to remember your dreams and kept a little notepad by my bedside. And one morning, I woke up, and the dream I recorded was that I was Prospero on my island, fighting mine enemies by means of shows. That is, I would, instead of trying to act upon you and force you to sit down, I would make you imagine that the ceiling was coming down at your head, and that would force you to, that psychologically would force you to sit down. And when I looked back at the play, that really is the way he functions. He doesn't do anything to anybody. He makes a fake shipwreck that doesn't even get people wet, but scares the hell out of them. And he, throughout the play, he doesn't behave like a typical Shakespearean revenge story. Our typical Shakespearean revenger would have, you know, knives and kill people.
Correct.
Or gouge their eyes out. But instead, what Prospero does is makes these haunting, scary, sometimes, you know, psychologically assaulting shows for them. And we thought that it might be interesting in this play to let the audience experience this level of amazement and distress that the other characters are experiencing by doing that to them with magic tricks.
How true to Shakespeare is this? I know you're a Shakespeareophile. You've done Macbeth, and what was it? Did you do Midsummer Night's Dream as well?
I did a Midsummer Night. That's the first show I ever worked on Aaron with. He was directing Midsummer Night's Dream in Philadelphia and invited me to help him with the magic there. And then he and I did a Macbeth a few years ago that was similar in nature, of trying to share the inner life of the characters, the hallucinations of the characters with the audience.
So how true to Shakespeare is Tempest?
It's very true. I think this is the production that Shakespeare would have done if he had had the resources of the ART.
Was he into magic? Was Shakespeare into magic?
Well, there certainly is evidence in such surviving stage directions as we have from The Tempest, where he says, and by a quaint device, the feast vanishes, or the banquet vanishes. Quaint device, I think, is Shakespearean lingo for magic trick. Mm.
Tell people, you know, we assume that the WGBH, Boston Public Radio listener, knows the story of The Tempest from beginning to end, but maybe there are a few who don't. What is the basic story of The Tempest?
Prospero and Miranda, father and daughter, are the duke and princess-to-be in Milan, which in Shakespeare's time is Milan. And Prospero becomes obsessed with magic, and because he descends so deeply into this fascination with magic, he says to his brother, "Why don't you just take care of running the state?" Well, this awakens an evil nature in his brother, and his brother takes over, plunks Prospero and Miranda into a rowboat that is described as so rotten that even the rats had instinctively quit it, and drops them in the middle of the ocean, assuming they're going to die of exposure. But they don't. They find their way to an island, and they live there for 12 years, during which time Prospero hones his magic powers with the magical forces on the island, so that he keeps the island in control. It's full of these strange things like Ariel and air spirit. And they find Caliban, the son of a witch, monster, on the island. And Prospero's keeping control of that when, at the beginning of this play, his brother and some other people who done him wrong many years ago come sailing by on a boat, and Prospero decides to take revenge. And the story of this is how Prospero moves from merely being revengeful to realizing that revenge is really not the way to go about life.
And part of this production, two of the words that are overused in the English language, at least in my estimation, are hero and genius. Having said that, Tom Waits is a genius.
Yes.
He is just how'd you hook into him? He's an old buddy of yours or something?
I met Tom in the 1980s when he was doing Frank's Wild Years at Steppenwolf in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Some people who knew me and knew him thought that I would be helpful in creating some hallucinations for a drunk in a bar, which is, of course, a character that Tom is quite adept at playing. And I went out and I taught Tom a few basic sleight of hand tricks, and he immediately performed them better than almost any magician I've ever seen because he invested them with so much humor. He's such an actor. And when this production began to happen, somehow or other, Aaron and I were talking about the style of music, and we got in touch with Tom and Kathleen, and Tom said, "Hey, I don't like Shakespeare very much." And Kathleen said, "I love Shakespeare." And we got together, and we had a book that has sort of been the touchstone of the production, which is the story of Willard the Wizard, a magician who toured the Dust Bowl during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And we paged through and showed Tom pictures of this. And there's one page that shows Willard the Wizard's band on stage. And they're all these, it's like five rail-thin Depression-era people, in suits, formally facing the audience with hats on. And a woman singing at the audience in this tent through an acoustic megaphone, that sort of thing. And Tom looked down and said, "Those are my people."
That's a good
great
Tom Waits imitation.
That's because I'm a little congested.
We're talking with Teller, half of Penn and Teller. You've all heard of their legendary illusionist duo that everybody knows about. A lot of people would love to have a career like your career. How'd you start? How'd you start getting into this whole magic illusion kind of stuff?
When I was 5 years old, I got sick. There are really two ways you get into magic. You get really, really sick, or you commit a crime and get imprisoned. And both of those things give you time to practice with nobody else around. When I was five, I got a really bad heart ailment. And while I was recovering, we had just bought a TV, and I was watching the Howdy Doody show.
Oh my
On it,
gosh.
There was a magical clown named Clarabelle.
I can't believe he's bringing Clarabelle up. Because go ahead.
Go tell me.
The most haunting experience of my young life.
Yeah.
Clarabelle was a character. You might be able to relate to this. Clarabelle did not do what? Speak.
Speak, yes.
Speak on the show. Howdy Doody's Buffalo Bob and all that.
Yep.
And On the did you see the final episode, Teller?
I don't think so.
The final episode
yeah.
is 30 seconds from being over. I'm a little boy. You were a little boy. Mm-hmm. Clarabelle looks into the camera and says, "Goodbye, kids." And I want you to know, and this is not it's not hyperbolic, I was haunted for years by the notion that Clarabelle, who I guess intellectually I knew, spoke, as most of us had a feeling you did, I was haunted by it for years. So I didn't mean to interrupt your story about Howdy Doody, but that's the impact it had on
me. A psychological insight into Jim here that we all enjoyed.
And you know when I thought about it the most? When I was in prison, actually, for a couple of years. And but I'm sorry. Go ahead with your story.
Clarabelle did magic tricks, and at one point they advertised that if you sent, I think it was 3 Mars bars wrappers and 50 cents, they would send you a Howdy Doody magic set.
Oh, my
gosh. And my parents, of course, I'm not addressing envelopes at the age of 5, but my parents sent away for it, and it came, and it was a flat envelope full of flat pieces of cardboard. And you took them out, and you cut out along the dotted lines, and then you tabbed these little things together, and they made little magic boxes.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a little magic box, and you open it, and you look inside, and there's 3 Mars bars in there, and then you sort of shake it up, and now there's 6, and then it can go back to 3. It was a really clever trick. And I'm sure my father must have sat down and helped me tab all of these things together. And I would sit in my parents had a storage room on the top floor of their Philadelphia row house that had very dirty windows. And in the afternoon, the sun would stream through those windows and the windows would light up. And I would sit there and just obsessively play with this magic set. And for some reason, that opened a chasm. You know, that it was a bit of psychological bedrock that I hit on really early. And I pursued that, in backyard magic shows. And then that led me to be interested in theater. So I got into local theater groups. And when I was in high school, I went to the same high school.
Yes, Teller and I went to Central
exactly.
High School. We did.
And I had a marvelous high school drama coach named David Rosenbaum, who loved Shakespeare, loved the classics. We did Oedipus Rex in high school, and people were crying. It was really something. He had Oedipus addressing the whole school from the same podium that the principal addressed the school, knew what his role was. I mean, he's a clever theatrical guy and really opened my eyes to how theater can work. So then I went off and went to college, studied Latin and Greek, became a Latin teacher, and in 1975, Penn called me up and said, I had become acquainted with Penn and a third partner named Weir, called me up and said, how'd you like to do magic this summer? I said, sure. He said, it goes through October. I said, oh, that's when school starts. And he said, yes, that's what we had in mind. So I took a year's leave of absence, and that turned into a permanent leave of absence.
But, before you move away from your childhood, I just wonder, you did a lot of magic tricks, I would assume, for your classmates and things at parties and things like that, did you?
I did magic tricks for, I believe, at the very bottom of the inferno, I forget which ring of that is, I did magic tricks for Cub Scouts. That's how horrible my life was. And I remember one of the most painful experiences of my career, which I date from starting at that point, was being there and making the enormous mistake of producing hard candy, which I tossed out to the children, to the Cub Scouts, who immediately began firing it back at me.
Oh, no.
And I was in tears.
I thought it would have made you heroic among your friends to be able to do these magic tricks. I thought that was so cool.
No,
really?
Cub Scouts, brutal. Brutal.
Oh, that's terrible.
The worst, most cruel possible audience.
So, Teller, since I'm sure you want some more Clarabelle trivia to take with you to your next. You want another one?
Sure.
Sure, why not? There were 3 people who played Clarabelle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who the first and most famous was?
Was it the same guy who played Captain Kangaroo?
Yes, it was. Bob Keeshan. That's right.
Yeah.
And isn't Clarabelle somebody's daughter? I haven't seen The Tempest in years. I'm going to come. Marjorie and I are both going to come see your production. Isn't Clarabelle somebody's daughter in The Tempest, if I'm right? The king or somebody?
Yes. Clarabelle, I think, is the name of the... I think that's the name of the daughter who's now Queen of Tunis, that they're on the way to or from her wedding.
Okay.
So Clarabelle was already, gender questionable.
Can we
Shakespeare
get
back to the
maybe saw Captain Kangaroo as a youth himself. I don't know.
Hey, as somebody who has been performing for ages, as you said, what's more anxiety provoking for you, being on stage or with Aaron Posner putting something together and other people doing it for you, and you just have to stand there after your work is done and hope that it's as good as you know it to be.
Well, I don't stand there. What I do is I stand there with a little notepad, and then the next day I go in for 4 hours in the afternoon and I say, let's fix this now, shall we? Neither of them is anxiety-producing, really. They all make the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck, but if I didn't love that, I should get into bookkeeping.
Yeah. Our goal, until you mentioned Clarabelle, was to go the furthest into an interview with you in your whole life where we didn't mention silence, but we blew it when you mentioned Clarabelle. What's the dumbest question you've been asked, Teller, when you actually speak about you not speaking for the most part in Penn and Teller?
It's mostly people make jokes. You know, it's that.
What's a bad one? Because I'm probably going to make one.
Yeah, we want to avoid it, no, actually.
Well, no, I mean, just by raising it, you've already done it.
Oh, too late. Too late. We plotted this out perfectly.
I mean, I know that there is a certain novelty. It's as if a pig walked up to the microphone and started to speak. So I get all kinds of credit for intelligence that I don't really have.
Yeah, but you have talked on many occasions. One of them was the NPR thing about Houdini. Yeah.
Was there an NPR thing about Houdini?
Yes, there was.
Oh, I know there was a television thing about Houdini.
It was an NPR thing, too, at least according to our vast research that we did this morning. So they maybe stole the thing and they played it on NPR. But in any case, you talked a lot about Houdini.
Yeah.
And give us your 2 cents on Houdini in the realm of magicians.
Well, Houdini's the only magician who has ever mattered. Because he did more than just amuse. He stepped outside the frame, and spoke to some very deep things that people were feeling at the time. He was an immigrant, and the United States was full of immigrants and all people who were fleeing oppressive governments. And his whole the centerpiece of his act was what he called self-liberation. So already there is a subtext that speaks to everybody. Houdini was also in an age where people had just started to work in factories and in cities. Houdini was a fitness nut, and so he became an icon of fitness as well. So when you see all of those pictures in which Houdini's on the front page of newspapers wearing basically nothing but some discreetly placed chains, that's also speaking to something that's very deep in what people were looking for at the time. And then in his latter days, the religion of spiritualism was very popular, and it was being promoted by a lot of creeps who were using magic trick technology to persuade people that they were talking with their dearly beloved dead. And this outraged Houdini, who was very close to his mother. And when his mother died, he tried contacting spiritualists to see whether they could indeed speak to his mother. Indeed, people as famous as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife believed that they could communicate with the dead. And when Houdini was found that these people produced disappointing answers or absolutely simply conjuring tricks masquerading as religious contact with the realm beyond, this outraged him. And so there's a whole part of his career that was a moral campaign to prevent people from being sucked in by these frauds. So he hit the world, apart from the fact that he was an astoundingly intense performer. He would come to he had a voice with the power of an opera singer, right? Hugely powerful voice. And when he would step to the footlights with these steely blue eyes, people described it as he looked like a panther about to spring into their midst. So combine an intense personal presence with these things that rode on what people were feeling about already, combined with this very important moral point that it's tremendously important to consult magicians if you want not to be fooled by frauds. And you have the ingredients for the only magician who ever really dug himself so deeply into the world's psyche. Other magicians are mild entertainers.
That was wonderful. I'm so glad I asked you about Houdini.
That's the voice of Teller, who there in Posner has adapted Shakespeare's The Tempest. That is at the Great ART. Is there an illusion that you've been dying to master for much of your career that you haven't quite gotten down yet, Teller?
Well, there's something that's I had really always wanted to do a spectacular levitation. Well, which is which is in the show, mm-hmm. you know, which is in the
I see a picture of it. I think isn't it this here?
That is a picture.
Could you
of
show
it.
That to our radio audience?
Please, go ahead, by the way.
Well, it is a woman. It is a woman in a beautiful gown. Being, she looks like she's about 3 or 4 feet off the floor.
It's. You recall Willard the Wizard, the person whose image sort of inspired the feel of the show. One of the wonderful things that Willard the Wizard used to do in his tent was levitate his daughter at practically the footlights of the stage. Now, in a tent, there's no fly loft above to attach wires to, so this was quite a miracle. And it's a thing that I'd always wanted to touch on. And in The Tempest, there is a moment. The Tempest is mostly very contemporary. But there are a couple of sections of it that just don't hold for present-day audiences. And one of those is what's called The Mask, where Prospero has now betrothed his lovely daughter Miranda to the Prince of Naples, Ferdinand, and he wants to show off as a magician. And in Shakespeare's original, what he does is he calls in spirits who recite couplets about fertility and generation. And these couplets go on quite a long while, and they're not among the best moments of the text. And he calls it doing some vanity of his art. So we thought that for Prospero to do one spectacular magic trick that also was deeply romantic and was about betrothing his daughter to Ferdinand would be appropriate. And we looked at the Willard stuff and we said, let's do that levitation. But in the midst of that levitation, let's have Prospero present his beautiful daughter's hand to Ferdinand as he sits by watching in wonder. And we found the perfect Tom Waits song to put with this, which is Shiny Things, which is this heartbreakingly beautiful song from the point of view of someone who is saying that crows put in their nests things that glitter. And this guy wants to be to his beloved that shiny thing. So it's really quite something.
Oh, my God. We can't wait. Do you have an ART experience before? Do you have a connection before this, or is this a
no,
first?
No, I was at the Boston production of Sleep No More, mm-hmm. that sort of environmental version of Macbeth. And that's where I first encountered the ART people personally. And that was 5 years ago? And there's a long and windy path led us to this.
Now, before you go, Teller, if you can give me a little bit of advice. One of the things, I have two goals in life that I have not achieved. One, I would like to be a clue in a crossword puzzle. Marjorie was a clue
in the
Wall Street Journal crossword puzzle. That you can't help me with. My other dream was to be inducted into the Central High School Hall of Fame for alumni. Now, not only are you in the alumni, mm-hmm. but when I broached it with you, when you walked into the studio, what was really depressing to me is you didn't even know that you had been inducted into the alumni. So do you have any advice for a lesser graduate of Central High School, the only boys public high school in the United States, which the Supreme Court of the United States said separate but equal was okay in terms of gender? Any advice from you?
In the old days. I would say contribute a lot of money. I think that would put you right into the Hall of Fame. I would say one of my proudest moments was that I've been a clue in the jumble puzzle twice.
You have
oh
not.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I have. And that was my father's favorite puzzle. So it was very, very gratifying.
Boy, that is pretty great.
That is pretty. You mean the word jumble things and you were in there?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love the jumbles.
I was the picture. Penn and I were the picture in one and I was the picture. Excuse me, I was the picture in the other.
Now I have three things on my list.
Yeah, I think that goes above it all. The jumble puzzle, forget the Hall of Fame, forget the other regular puzzle. The jumble puzzle, that is it.
Teller, it's a pleasure to meet you. We can't wait to see The Tempest at the ART. We will be there.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in. It was absolutely wonderful, wonderful to talk with you. Teller has adapted and directed a new production of The Tempest along with Alan Posner. It's on stage at the ART through...
By the way, it's Aaron, but that's close enough.
To the ART through June 15th. To learn more about the tickets and showtimes, go to the AmericanRepertoryTheater.org.
Coming up, Matt Miller from Innovation Hub right here on Boston Public Radio.
The Crime of Being a Worker.
Congress starts to restrict this migration and make it illegal, creating this status of illegality for people who are doing the same thing that they've been doing for many generations.
How the idea of illegality clouds our ability to understand the immigration problem in America. Who is a criminal and who is an immigrant? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Xconomy.com, presenting Boston 2034 on June 10th, exploring the ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the economy in the years to come. More at Xconomy.com/Boston2034.
Oh, my goodness. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If walls had ears. I am Jim Browdy.
Only aired the breaks.
She is Marjorie Egan. In the land of opportunity, from the cereal aisle to the mega menus at the Cheesecake Factory, they're unbelievable. Are we undone by having too much to choose from? When it comes to making the best decision, is less more? Here with us in Studio 3 to begin this discussion, we're going to continue it next week because I love this topic about the art of choosing, is Kara Miller, who, as you know, is host of the Innovation Hub. Hello there, Kara.
Hi.
Hello, Kara Miller. So this is just fascinating, and I can totally relate to this. You talked to Sheena Iyengar, who's the choice guru.
Yeah, the guru, right.
Yes, and tell us about this experiment she did at the Jam store.
So this is a famous experiment now because she went to this upscale California food store and set up a jam display. And she set up 24 different varieties of jam, and people could stop by. Everybody's seen this kind of thing. You stop by, you taste a couple, and then they give you a $1 off coupon for a thing of jam. So when they set up a table with 24 flavors of jam, lots of people stopped by. Lots of people tasted. Almost nobody bought anything. So then they set up a table with just 6 different flavors of jam. Not quite as many people stopped by. Many people, but not quite as many people. And many people bought. Because when you're faced with all these choices, you tend to kind of have a little bit of a mental meltdown, and you are so overwhelmed, you step away. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had that experience.
All the time.
Right? Hello.
Like, all the time.
I don't go to the Cheesecake Factory to eat for 2 reasons. One, because this is true. I'd weigh 400 pounds if I did. Biggest portions in America. Secondly, there have got to be 1,000 choices. It is paralyzing.
See, because people love choice. So you notice more people went over to the table when it had more flavors, but they did not buy. And I think there is, you know, the Cheesecake Factory realizes that people love choice, but there is this kind of also built-in regret to that choice. Like, you get halfway through that piece of cheesecake and you think, you know what I really should have gotten?
Exactly.
The turtle cheesecake. Like, that would have been so much better. And that's
but
part
of the
problem.
But is that what it is? That when there's so many choices, you say to yourself when you're experiencing the one you selected that I could have had all those other ones and I probably – is that what it is?
I think some of it is that. Some of it is also just a paralysis that comes with choice. So it turns out when you give people lots of choices for where to put their money in their 401k – they don't invest money in their 401k. They just leave it there in cash, which makes no money at all. So instead of like they are offered 10 choices. They're all pretty decent. What do? Nothing. You offer them 2 choices. They actually take their money in their 401k and they do something worthwhile. And you're seeing Fidelity and Vanguard start to realize that you give people a lot of choices, which you would think would be more is better, right? This is America. More is better. And it turns out it's not better, and people do nothing with their money, which ends up hurting them.
Well, you know, the 401k thing makes so much sense to me because if you know nothing about investments, which a lot of us don't, including myself, you think, okay, if there's 2 choices, it's 50-50. Then I'm right. But if it's 10 choices, you know, there's a 9 out of 10 choice. I'm going to totally blow it,
right,
and lose money. You know,
right.
So I can totally relate to that. I'm paralyzed. I still haven't invested in the 401k because I can't. I don't know where to put it.
Well, Sheena Iyengar talks about this great experiment she did with kids, which kind of shows that this choice thing is really built in, sort of baked into us since we were little kids. So she said, you know, she was doing this experiment really to see how Asian and Caucasian children treated choice differently. That's really what she was trying to find out. So she would bring kids into this room filled with toys and say, you get to choose a toy and then you can play with it. And she would notice that after a few minutes, the kid became like despondent, didn't play with the toy, and did nothing but look out the window. And she thought, well, obviously, I must not know what I'm doing. I didn't pick good toys. So she went like back to the toy store, picked a whole bunch of much better toys, brought them into the room. Same experience. The kids would look at all the toys, very excited, pick one, and then just be really just nothing. And she realized that the kids who went into the room where there was only one or two toys offered to them, generally it was Legos, were really happy and they played with the toys. But the kids who didn't, they just like had a mental meltdown when they were presented with that many toys. They sort of couldn't handle it. And she said, if you've ever had the experience of going into like Toys R Us with a little kid and have them going from being, oh my God, this is so exciting, to just a temper tantrum in about 10 minutes, yep, it's because they cannot deal with the choice that's in front of them.
You know what? I've told you this before, but not in this context, because I never knew about the research before. I've told Marjorie about this before. When I used to live in New York City, there was a restaurant a few blocks where I lived on the upper west side on West 72nd Street. I can't remember the name. We're just west of Broadway. They had one soup, one entree, and one dessert every single night. And when I first moved to the neighborhood, I said, who is possibly ever going to go there? And I'd say, well, I guess if you call in advance and it's something you like. All my friends would go there all, and they changed it every day, all the time. And I ultimately ended up loving it because all the food was great. But part of it, I guess, without, and I never thought of this, is because you didn't have to make a decision. You knew they were good cooks. You knew it was high quality food. And you didn't have to make a selection. I mean, I'm sure that's what it was.
Absolutely. And companies now are getting very smart about this. So you probably don't think about this, but do you ever shop at Trader Joe's?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So they have many fewer choices. Think about this next time
you're
going.
Is that really true?
Many fewer choices than an average supermarket. Like a fifth of the choices in an average supermarket. Yeah, because they have a lot of Trader Joe's brands, and they don't offer much else.
Yep.
If you go into a regular supermarket, you might have 50 choices for beans or 20 choices for beans. At Trader Joe's, there's a couple, and they have done incredibly well. Steve Jobs was actually a genius at this. People would be in meetings with him, and he would say, you know, what's in our product line? And they'd be like, well, we want these 7 things. And he'd be like, great. What are the 3 best? And erase everything else that is not going to be in our product line. We're going to offer people like black and white, the end. And people loved it. Right?
Well, that gets back to food again, though. If you have chocolate cake or you have yellow cake, but if you have like the cheesecake or the carrot cake or the rum cake and all these things, it's very upsetting. Buffets are very upsetting to lots of people for the same sort of reasons. And you know where else this comes into? You know, this idea of you could have done better. Talk to 20-somethings about their dating life when they have, you know, the constant thing about, well, this guy's pretty good or this girl's pretty good, but maybe I can do better. When is good enough?
That is a tricky part about online dating, because it's like the endless bar, right? It's like the
bar
that you go into, but instead of having 80 people in the bar, there's an infinite number of people in the bar, and that's a very sort of paralyzing thing.
Well, you know what, I don't know if this is an exception. In my view, this is the golden age of television. I watch more television than I watched since I was a little kid. And some of that, we talked to Bob Thompson from Syracuse every 2 weeks. Some of the stuff is brilliant. There's so many stations that is totally out of control. Is overall TV viewership down? And by the way, I have Sunday nights, there's so many things on. You don't know what to watch. And often I tape everything. I don't watch them because some of them are overlapping and that sort of thing. And I watch them, you know, when I have time during the week. But is there any evidence that people are drawing away from television because there are hundreds and hundreds of channels and hundreds of choices?
I think that there is evidence that people are converging on certain things that people talk to them about, like the Mad Men and the Breaking Bad and that kind of thing, and that there is a vast wasteland of other things that basically get nothing else.
For this reason, potentially.
Yes. And it's funny. I was talking to somebody, not that I won't mention the person's name because they used to work in commercial television, and he was telling me, this is a few months ago, he was telling me that when he left commercial television, that things like the Kardashians had been so popular that all people really wanted to do was make that show. And so Animal Planet would put out calls for new shows and they would say, please do not pitch us anything with animals in it because we are not interested. And you're like, I mean, this is Animal Planet. Like, what the heck are you supposed to pitch them? But everybody really just wanted to replicate the same show over and over and over again. They really, I think in a lot of ways, we don't deal very well with this sort of diversity of like, there's a thousand different things on right now. What do you want to watch? I think people want to hear you, Jim, say to them, you know what's really good? Mad Men. And then you go and you listen to it.
You know what this should be called? When you speak to this Sheena Yanger, is how you
yes,
say it?
Yes,
she should call it the Cheesecake Factory Factor, is what it I mean, that is what it is it not?
No, it's. I don't like going there at all.
You know, we're
going to
do this.
Why?
We've never done this before. We're going to continue this next week.
Okay.
Only because I love the topic. I know Marjorie does too. We're going to invite phone calls
okay,
as well. Because my
great.
Sense is a lot of people have suffered this kind of choice paralysis.
Kara, what are you doing tonight?
We are talking to Joy Ito, who is behind a lot of great tech companies. He's at MIT. He never graduated from college, and he talks about what it means to fail and why it's really important.
Okay, that's tonight at 9.
Yes.
And Saturday at 10
is choice. And we talked to David Pogue about what gadgets are on his list right now, what he wants.
Okay, Kara, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks,
we'll talk again about this next week. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for our Friday news quiz and Emily's List. Thanks, Chelsea, Will, Alan, and John. John Park's not here today.
No, he's not, but thank him, Emily.
But Will is here. Anyway, I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Brown.
Thank God I said my name right.